This is Writer's Voice. Today we sit down with award-winning author Victoria Christopher Murray to talk about Harlem Rhapsody, her novel about the Harlem Renaissance and the woman who ignited it. This gripping novel brings to life Jessie Redmond Fawcett, a pioneering literary editor, mentor, and novelist who played a pivotal role in shaping the Harlem Renaissance, yet who remains largely forgotten today. Then we talk with the founders of a new publishing company featuring women authors of an earlier time. Bramond Barry McDougall and Lisa Cooper founded Quite Literally Books, which is coming out with Jessie Redmond Fawcett's 1928 novel, Plum Bun, along with two other books. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Jessie Redmond Fawcett was one of the most influential women in American literary history, yet few remember her today. She helped spark the Harlem Renaissance in her role as literary editor of The Crisis, the magazine of the NAACP. But she carried a secret. Her boss, W.E.B. Du Bois, wasn't just her mentor, he was also her lover. At least that's what novelist Victoria Christopher Murray imagines in her wonderful novel about Jessie Fawcett, Harlem Rhapsody. She creates narrative tension between Fawcett's secret liaison with Du Bois and her mission to scout and champion literary talent among young black writers. Fawcett discovered and mentored such future literary giants as Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and Nella Larson. As a black woman, she stood as a singular figure at the center of a cultural revolution, contending with both racial and gender prejudice to cement her place in history. Victoria Christopher Murray is the New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of more than 30 novels. Victoria Christopher Murray, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This novel, Harlem Rhapsody, explores the world of the Harlem Renaissance in the early decades of the 20th century, in the 20s, late teens and 20s. It explores the life of a real woman who was, as you call her, the heartbeat of the Harlem Renaissance, Jessie Redmond Fawcett. She was key in bringing writers like Langston Hughes, County Cullen, and so many more to the public. And the novel also centers around an illicit affair between her and W.E.B. Du Bois. So first, tell us about Jessie, and then we'll talk a little bit about the affair.
Yes, so Jessie Redmond Fawcett is exactly what you said. She was the woman who ignited the Harlem Renaissance. And what is so fascinating to me about this whole thing is whenever you say, everyone knows the Harlem Renaissance. But when you talk about the Harlem Renaissance and the voices and the names, you hear Langston Hughes, County Cullen, sometimes you'll hear Zora Neale Hurston just kind of slipped in there. You've never heard Jessie Redmond Fawcett when she was the woman who ignited the whole thing. Not only did she find all of these writers, she discovered them, mentored them, edited them, and then published them before anyone else. Not only did she do all of that, but she wrote four novels during this period herself. She was the most prolific writer of the Harlem Renaissance, and no one knew her name.
Well, they knew her name back then.
Yes. Oh, yes. In the 100 years since, we've lost her name, but I'm hoping to bring that back.
And I really think you have. I mean, this is really a page-turner. You know, it entertains and also teaches. Now, tell us about W.E.B. Du Bois. Of course, most of us know who he was, but just center him in this book at the time the book takes place.
So he was really one of the people at the center of the Harlem Renaissance. I don't think he meant to be, but he was, because he was the one who founded the Crisis magazine, which was the periodical for Black voices. So it wasn't just Black people subscribing to it. The NAACP was founded mostly by white people. So it was Black and white people who wanted to know news about what was going on in the Black communities nationally. And he was the founder, he was one of the founders of the NAACP, the founder of the Crisis magazine, which was also the only place where a Black writer could be published during that time. And he brought Jesse Redmond Fawcett from Washington, D.C. to New York to be the literary editor. And so by him making that move, he created a movement without knowing that that's what she was going to do, that she was going to take this invitation and turn it into one of the greatest literary movements of our time. But W.E.B. Du Bois at the time was considered the greatest thinker of the Black community. He was the first Black man to get a PhD from Harvard. And many people considered him the leader of all Black and brown people around the world. He also started a movement called the Pan-African Congress, which was in, which is also in the book. And he was just a person who was trying to fight for equality for Black people. And he wanted to use everything that he could, including the arts, to get his point across.
So in this book, W.E.B. Du Bois mentors Jesse Fawcett, but they're also having an affair. And this is something that, you know, was hinted about. If you go to the Wikipedia page, it's not even mentioned, but other places do. Why did you include this as such a central?
Yes, because I actually thought about trying to write it without that. Because I didn't, not that I'm one writer who could change somebody's legacy, but especially when introducing Jesse, I didn't want that to be the focus. But as I tried to write this, Francesca, it was so interesting to me because as I tried to write it without their affair, but I had to still have them interacting, it felt like there were plot holes. It felt like, why in the world did she leave where she was going to go to New York? Okay, she wanted to be the literary editor. Why were they always together? Why was she doing all the work? Why was she's such a big part of his life? Like you mentioned, there were the other places that talk about them. One of the things they always say is that Jesse and W.E.B. Du Bois were always together, always together. And so I would have had that in there. And I think people would have said, she's hinting at something. Why not just tell the whole story? And there's another reason why I decided to do it. And it was a hard thing to do. I think I may have thought a little bit more about it. But David Levering Lewis wrote the Pulitzer Prize biographies of W.E.B. Du Bois. And he's the one who talks most about their affair. He's the one in the biography who talks about Du Bois' relationships with other women. But Jesse Redmond Fawcett is the only one he named. And then he calls them star-crossed lovers. And I really wanted to think about what that meant. And the only time I really had ever heard that was in high school when we read Romeo and Juliet. And so they were really very involved. So I had to tell the whole story. Before I started writing historical fiction, I would write all kinds of fiction. I wrote contemporary fiction. And one of the things I always tried to do was to stay true to the characters. Always create authentic, real, flawed characters. And now that I was dealing with real people, it almost felt like if I left that part out, I wouldn't be doing what I've always done as a writer, which is creating the whole character. And it was such an important part of their life. You know, Jesse, as the literary editor, started this movement. It was called the New Negro Renaissance at the time. And she started it. There was never a literary editor before her at the Crisis, and there was never a literary editor after her at the Crisis. It was just that one period of time. And if I didn't say that she was there because W.E.B. Du Bois wanted her to be close, it wouldn't have made any sense.
What's also interesting, though, is that it allows you to explore some of the issues of gender in the book, you know, which were important issues to Jessie Fawcett herself that she wrote about in her novels. And one of the things you say in the book is that, you know, unlike what often happens when women have relationships, illicit affairs with married men, they want to get married to them, they want to break up the original relationship. That's not what she wanted. So talk about Jessie Fawcett and her feminism.
Yeah, you know, she was a little bit ahead of her time, and I actually had to take out some scenes because the book was getting too long. But she really had a focus when she was putting this literary movement together, a focus on female writers. I focused on the male writers because those are the bigger names that we know. But Nella Larson's in the book, Gwendolyn Bennett's in the book, all of these people who were very important to the Renaissance. And one of the things that Jessie decided very early on in her life was that she was not going to be married. She wanted to focus on her career. And I found that fascinating because that's the same struggle that women have today. So many women have the same struggle. But she felt that her place, her role would be to uplift women. And she did it so much. She did it by bringing in the women writers, by bringing in the women illustrators. Even when she went to Brussels and gave that big speech in at the conference, which made her an international star, actually. Newspapers all through the world, from Africa to Asia, had posted about her, this speech that she gave about Negro women at the time. But she just believed that women could be equal to men, but she knew she had to give up a part of her life, which was getting married, in order to do it. And so W.E.B. became a comfortable place for her, because she could have a relationship, but she didn't have to have the marriage and the commitment. And he believed in her focus on the crisis. If he had been married to her, I believe he would have wanted her to be home.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you mentioned that speech. I was actually going to ask you about that. It was at the first Pan-African Congress. Actually, there were three different venues for it. It was at the second venue. She gives a speech about the first three Black women to get a PhD in America. And yet those women, like Jessie Fawcett herself, who graduated from Cornell University, had a lot of difficulty in getting jobs.
Isn't that something? You know, it makes me sad because the only reason they had trouble getting jobs was because of the color of their skin. If there had been full equality, there would never be any need for DEI programs or anything. But even back then, and they were the first Black women to receive PhDs. And I was so happy when I read about her speech. The only thing I knew about the speech was that it was about the Negro woman in America. I knew that she held up the pictures of those three, and she talked about the importance of Black women in America and moving America forward. That's all I knew. So I had to write the whole speech just based on that. And I just kind of figure I'm pretty close to what she was trying to say and what she wanted to say. She was a woman before her time in lots of ways.
And also a woman of her time in the sense of the first wave of feminism. You know, she wrote about equality. You write in the book about the suffragette movement. And there's a very interesting scene in the book, Harlem Rhapsody, in this novel, Victoria Christopher Murray. And that is on the day that women get the vote. What happens in that scene?
Yes, that she brings together all the important women in her life. And one of the most important women in her life, and I know we'll probably talk about that, is her mother. And her mother, who was fascinating, who could have her own book. Her mother was really her stepmother, but the only mother that Jessie knew, because her biological mother died when she was a toddler, so she had no memory of her. But her father married a white Jewish woman who raised Jessie and who was with her throughout this book. And if you think about it, Francesca, in a way, her mother was a feminist as well, not in terms of her role, but in what she pushed Jessie to do, and how she supported Jessie. And so the day, or I think it was like the week of women getting the right to vote, Jessie brings together all the important women in her life, from her mother to the librarian of the library in Harlem, which is the library of the Harlem Renaissance, to her friends, and they don't know each other. Some of them know each other. And so she brings together this group. I think there may have been 6, 7, 8 of them. I can't remember. To just talk about, what does it mean for women to have the right to vote now? And it becomes a very interesting discussion, because it's a celebration. But then Nella Larson brings up, is it a celebration for all of us? I think the white women in this room are going to be able to vote. But Black men have had the right to vote for 50 years and have never been able to really vote. So it becomes an interesting discussion of, look at this gender celebration, but we still have a lot of racial issues.
Yeah, exactly. So now let's turn to talking about some of the people that she did discover. She was the first person to publish one of my favorite poets, Langston Hughes.
She probably published the first 20-25 pieces that he wrote. At one point in the book, I was going to count them, and it just got to be too many, because he also wrote for the children's magazine. But, you know, they had the very first one in The Crisis, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. She discovered him when he was 17. He was in high school. And he then wrote little pieces for her for the children's book. But when he sent in that piece, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, she said, there is a Negro writer out here and the world needs to know him. And so I love that. One of the things I did like about writing about all the people that she discovered is she discovered them very young, and they were all going through their own issues as she discovered them. So Langston had the issue of, he had his father, he had a very interesting mother. One of the things I didn't know before I researched this was his rich history and his ancestors. I didn't know he had a great uncle who wrote one of the first civil rights acts of 1875, James Mercer Hughes. So it was interesting to find out more about them. And then Jessie was a mentor to them, and she would guide them through their issues. So she had to guide him through the issues that he had with his father and the issues he had as a Black student at Columbia University.
What were some of those issues?
So the issues with his father was, his father did not want him to be a writer. His father wanted him to major in engineering at Columbia. His father had lived in Mexico since Langston was about 5 years old. So they didn't have a really good relationship. And his father even said to him, if you go to New York and you major in writing, don't ever contact me again. So there's that kind of feeling of abandonment. His mother was much closer to him, loved him, adored him, but she spent most of her time when he was a child living in other cities looking for work. And he was raised by his grandmother in Kansas. And then one of the biggest issues was, he had challenges at Columbia, which I read recently that Columbia did a public apology to Langston Hughes. He had an issue because they didn't want him in a dorm because he was Black. He had issues where, and I found this in some of the letters he wrote, where only his French teacher would meet with him. Other professors ignored him at best. And he ends up dropping out of Columbia. And Jessie has to help him.
He speaks, just going back to his father for a minute, he speaks about his father taking a train ride with his father, and his father is, you know, really trash-talking black laborers who he sees from the window. So I wanted to ask you about some of the class issues in the book, black middle class versus working class.
Yes.
Talk about the talented 10th W.E.B. Du Bois and how you wrapped your mind around, pose the questions, tell us about that issue, and then how you wrapped your own mind around it.
So I've known about the talented 10th, which was a paper that W.E.B. Du Bois wrote about in the early 1900s that shook up Black America. And the talented 10th was, and remember, we're talking, this is only 50 years after emancipation. So very few Black people are educated. They were in, you know, had been enslaved. And so people were just getting their college degrees. People were just getting their masters. So these people here, they were one in two generations removed from slavery. And they were college educated professionals. And W.E.B. Du Bois was saying that there's not that many of us out here doing this because we're 50 years after emancipation. It's probably about 10% of the Black population. And we are the talented 10th. And it is going to take the talented 10th to lead the other 90% of uneducated Black people. And it really was a class and an education kind of divide, which honestly still exists. As I said, I've known about the talented 10th from the time I was a child. I don't think I knew what it was, but I'd heard about it. But my parents were college educated. And then all of my sisters, both of my sisters and myself, were all college educated. And with masters. And so it becomes a thing that sometimes it feels elitist. There's a fight in the Black community about it. But it was Du Bois who came up with the people who can get the education owe it to the rest of the race to bring them along. But that statement alone divides. And you have the class system.
Exactly. And of course, it does exist. Well, we have a pretty strong class system in this country, no matter who you are. And it's an issue and a question that is always suppressed. But I think of, you know, I think of Martin Luther King and the Poor People's Campaign and how he really sought to uplift the voices of poor people. And we can talk about the Reverend William Barber today, yeah, who's doing exactly the same in that same tradition. On the other hand, Du Bois is such a towering figure. And what he is talking about, we could say that's a practical issue.
You could say, right? Because doesn't it make sense? It just sounds bad. You know, it makes sense that there are going to be leaders. And where do leaders come from? And especially when, as I was just saying, you're only talking about 50 years out of slavery. And so there were just some people that rose to the top. Even with that, there were some people who were free already. And so it was just a way to take what he had at the time, to take what he had and to say, look, we need to be focused on bringing the rest of our race along. We must do it. And who's going to be the leaders? And like you said, very, very practical, but it does separate at the same time.
So back to Jesse Fawcett, in the book, the question is posed early about her affair with W.E.B. Du Bois that is going to end up sabotaging her own career. But in looking into her history, I really wonder, is the affair what sabotaged her career, or was it the fact that she was a woman? Because there's a really important dinner, for example, at the Civic Club. Maybe you can talk about the Civic Club in March of 1924. The idea was hatched by Charles Spurgeon Johnson, who was the first black president of Fisk University. He was the editor of Opportunity, which was another journal that was very important and published by the National Urban League. And it was supposed to be a dinner in her honor, but it ended up not being so much. And it's something that she was pretty upset about.
Really upset about it. I didn't even, it's outside of my story, but years later, she wrote a scathing letter to Elaine Locke about it, because it was totally supposed to be for her book. Totally. It was supposed to start out with 30 people, I think, maybe it was 10 people even. And it ended up being 300 people at the Civic Club, which was, because remember the timing, that was 1924, where there were few restaurants where Black people could go and have a meal. But the Civic Club was started by some of the founders, the white founders of the NAACP. And it was this upscale club that's still there. The name is a little different. It begins with an E now. I can't remember the name. But it was this upscale club where you had membership, and it was a mansion that was turned into a club, a restaurant, private rooms, all kinds of things. And so they were having this wonderful dinner. It was Charles Johnson's idea to do it, to have it for Jesse, because she had written the first novel of the Black middle class, the very first novel. And so it was a big thing for everyone. And she goes there just so ready to step into her place. And the men kind of stole her light. And it became a dinner for all writers. And she got to speak for maybe 3 seconds. I mean, 3 minutes, really. And it was sad. And it's really interesting because that was March 24th, 1924, was what they said was the beginning of the Harlem Renaissance. And this year, well, last year, March 24th, 2024, would have been 100 years of the Harlem Renaissance. And so on that day, the New York Times actually published an article about the dinner. And I think it started off with a line that as Jesse sat in the Civic Club, she wondered, how did this get taken from her? So everybody recognizes that. But, you know, it's interesting because I never thought about the fact that did they take it away from her because she was a woman? I just thought Elaine Locke just thought, you know, I think you're absolutely right, because he put up all the men to speak, and then he let her speak.
So I want to just go out on another question, and that is W.E.B. Du Bois talked in the book, and Jesse Fawcett, I think, agrees with him. He basically has the attitude that all art, all writing needs to be propaganda as long as Black people are oppressed in this country. So that kind of sets up the whole issue. Are you a Black writer? Are you a writer first? How do you, as a Black writer and a writer, deal with that question?
Isn't it so funny? There were so many parts of that book that talk about that. Jean Toomer, one of the writers of the Harlem Renaissance, refused to be recognized as a Black writer. Then you had the white patrons who were very important to the Renaissance, who felt that Black writers had a special, these white women really felt that Black writers had a special, like, superpower of creativity, which was bizarre, so that came into it. And Jean Toomer and Charlotte Mason, she was one of the biggest white patrons. Like, in today's time, she would have been giving them millions of dollars. She was giving them so much money. But Jean Toomer and Charlotte Mason, their stories in this book did make me say, who am I as a writer? And it's interesting. It's very interesting, especially with me writing this book, because I've written two other historical fictions with a co-author who is white. So this is my solo historical fiction. And I've written about a Black character, although there's no way to write the Harlem Renaissance with all the white characters that are in the book as well. But Jesse is the center of it. And I am even finding myself as I'm navigating the promotional part of this book. Am I a Black writer or am I just a writer? I want to be a writer. That's what I want to be. Because even in this book, as I said, I've had to put, there's white voices in there. So I want to be a writer. I think I am seen only as a Black writer.
And how does that feel?
I'm challenged by it. I've had some disappointments, even with this book and the promotional part of it. I've had some disappointments because of it. But it's such a reality of my life. You know, these are not my first disappointments. I've been through this rodeo before. So that's an interesting question to ask me as I'm going through this and navigating it and wanting to be seen as a writer, but some of the gatekeepers, and not my publisher. My publisher has been amazing. But some of the gatekeepers are saying, she's a Black writer, though. And she's not writing with the white writer this time. But you know what? I know I've written a wonderful book. Jesse Redmond Faucett is an amazing character that people must come to know. And I will just do what I've always done, and that's persevere.
Well, I'm so glad that you did, because this was just such a terrific book to read. And I think it's an important book, too. And I just can feel the spirit of Jesse Faucett being channeled right through you. It's just wonderful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Somebody else told me as he read the story, he said, I don't think anybody else could have written this. he said he loved that. And so that's a compliment. That's a kind thing to say. Thank you so much.
Victoria Christopher Murray. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Harlem Rhapsody. Next up, a new press is publishing Jesse Faucett's 1928 novel, Plum Bun, along with the work of other largely forgotten women authors. But first, let's listen to Langston Hughes reading his poem, Weary Blues.
One of the poems that I wrote in Harlem in the 1920s is a poem called The Weary Blues. Droning a drowsy syncopated tune, rocking back and forth to a mellow croon, I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of an old gas light, he did a lazy sway, to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody, oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues, coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice with a melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing, that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I was going to quit my frowning and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, 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 went his foot on the floor. Played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues, and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues, can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. Far into the night he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed. While the weary blues echoed through his head, he slept like a rock. Or a man that's dead.
That was Langston Hughes reading his poem, Weary Blues. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. As we heard earlier, women authors, and especially Black women authors, even if they were successful in their own time, have often been swiftly forgotten by succeeding generations. But two women, Bramon Berry McDougall and Lisa Cooper, are aiming to bring wonderful women writers of the past out of the shadows so that contemporary audiences can rediscover them. They founded a new press called Quite Literally Books. One of the first books they're republishing is Jessie Fawcett's novel about a black woman who passes for white, Plum Bun. They're also publishing The Homemaker by Dorothy Canfield Fisher and The Pink House by Nelia Gardner White, both big sellers in their own time, but largely unknown today. I spoke with Bermond Berry McDougall and Lisa Cooper this week. Let's listen to that conversation. Bermond Berry McDougall and Lisa Cooper, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. We are happy to be here.
I usually interview authors, but you are, and you have founded a new publishing enterprise called Quite Literally Books. Tell us what its mission is.
Our goal is to find and publish books that speak to us, that we think other women particularly will also find interesting or enlightening or helpful in some way. And we want to find books that we feel like are great reads, but also people haven't read them.
And you focus on books by women, unknown books that have gone out of print. Is that right, Lisa?
They tend to be either unknown or just ones that are sort of flying below the radar. Some of the books that we are reprinting can be found out in the world today, but for some reason or another, they're not getting a lot of attention. And so our hope is to shine a light on them. And also, another part of our mission, I guess, is not only to revive good stories and good books, but also to sort of revive the pleasure of a good reading experience. So our books are beautifully designed. They've been printed on incredible paper. They are beautiful to look at. They feel great to hold. They smell good. So the hope is to take some of these books that are maybe not getting as much attention as we think they deserve and package them in a way that it becomes like a real pleasure to read and maybe entice some more people to check these out.
You guys actually have known each other for a long time. You met in seventh grade. So say a little bit about yourselves and, you know, what brought you together on this project so many decades after you first met?
Lisa and I first met when we were 12 years old, and we were seventh graders in Austin, Texas, and we became friends almost immediately. And part of that was because we both loved to read so much, and we both loved books, and we loved to talk about books, and talk about what we were reading. And we've done that pretty much all along. We haven't lived in the same city in our adult lives, but we talk to each other, and often we talk about books or what are you reading? What's your recommendation?
We could go months without connecting. And then I would be standing in a bookstore wondering what to buy. And Bermond is the person that I text. So there's no like, hi, how are you? How are the kids? It's like, what are you reading? I'm standing here. What should I get? And Bermond is not necessarily the most prompt responder. But when she gets one of those texts, she writes me back right away with a list.
Because that's important.
But she's always been like that. She's even when we were 12, like some of my best reads came from Bermond. And we joke that, you know, she would swipe little paperbacks, trade paperbacks from her mother's stash. I would swipe them from my dad's and we would trade them. Bermond was a big reader in the bathtub and she would often drop her books in the bathtub. So I would get these sort of like crinkled, crispy offerings from her. But it's always been a part of our friendship. And we've always found that, like, we don't just talk about the books, you know, it makes us talk about ourselves. It definitely leads to much bigger conversations. And I think a book, that's like part of the magic of a good book, is like people who may not feel like they're stakeholders in a conversation or feel like they have an end to a conversation. If you read a book about it, then now you have something to talk about. There's a way to express yourself around that topic, and you now have an opinion. And I think that's one of the things that's really important about books.
Particularly, I think, in the case of Jessie Redmond Fawcett, who wrote Plum Bun, it's not fair to say that she's unknown. And Dorothy Canfield Fisher, similarly, because they were very well known in their own time, but they are still known. They're just not widely known or widely distributed, and we feel like they should be more widely. But I I want to stress that we did not discover Jessie Redmond Fawcett.
She's been reprinted over time. There's a great 2017 New Yorker article that talks about her. But what's interesting is even in that article, I think the writer asked a few, you know, notable authors of today, like, have you heard of Jessie Redmond Fawcett? And so many people have not. Even people who are in the know have not. So that's why we think it's wonderful that this Harlem Rhapsody book has been published.
And we both read it. We both read it over the weekend. So it so matches. We had our foreword written by a woman who did her master's thesis on Jessie Redmond Fawcett and her novels. And so we've read sort of her nonfiction take, and it was really interesting to see those things fleshed out in Harlem Rhapsody with dialogue. And yeah, it was really the meeting, the dinner for the publication of There Is Confusion, which turned into not being a celebration of Jessie Redmond Fawcett's accomplishment as an author, but turned into the launching of the New Negro Movement, and really wasn't about her at all and was sort of co-opted by the men. So we knew that, we read about that in the thesis, but then to have it sort of really fleshed out dramatically was really, that was really interesting.
Yes, and this is why I decided to have you guys on so soon. I just heard about your new publishing enterprise, Quite Literally Books, and it was just serendipity because we had just talked with Victoria Christopher Murray. So actually, let's start there. There are three books that you've issued. We'll talk first about Plum Bun. And the other two are The Homemaker by Dorothy Canfield Fisher and The Pink House by Nelia Gardner White. But we'll start with Jessie Fawcett's book, Plum Bun. The person who wrote your introduction, Danielle Slaughter, who you just mentioned, she says, as you start to read Fawcett's novels, I suggest approaching them from a Black feminist perspective. So talk about that perspective in the light of this book, Plum Bun. How is it expressed?
So what this book does is it takes away, I think, a lot of assumptions we have about what it is to be young and what it is to be Black and what it is to be a woman in the 1920s, and turns everything on its head. At least it did for me, because we're talking about a character who could exist today, and she has the exact same sort of concerns and the same sorts of feelings and issues that a young woman in the 2020s would have. And she is Black. She is a woman who is extremely talented. She's beautiful. She's ambitious. And she is always at the mercy and the whims, not only of her Blackness and what white people will put on that, but she's also at the mercy of what men think about women. So Bermond and I were talking, like, this is like a perfect book about intersectionality. You know, it's about a woman who is wanting more choices than the world is affording her, realizing that if she says nothing about the fact that she's Black, that the world will perceive her as white. And that if she just lets that be, then all of a sudden there's like a whole world of choice for her. However, she's still a woman. And then that pigeonholes her. That definitely, as the book unfolds, you see, like, yes, she's passing as white, so a lot of doors open for her, but she's still a woman. And that means that she's still at the whims of, like, how society, you know, will let her make choices or not. Whims of, like, the men that she's with, the choices that she gets to make around that. And not to talk too long, but I just do want to say, like, one of the best things about this book is that in exploring those things, Angela, the main character, she doesn't have like a very romantic idea about what her life can be. She's super practical. And in that sense, she almost thinks like a man. And it's so interesting for that to be a big part of the character. She's not hugely likable, but boy, do we respect the heck out of her, because she's so clear about what she wants. And she's so unafraid to try to go get it. but you do see growth over time. And what she wants at the beginning of the novel is not necessarily what she wants by the end of the novel.
Or what she thinks she needs. Because at the beginning, she thinks that she needs protection, that she needs male protection. And, you know, and she may have been right.
I do want to point out, and I think this is, Danielle Slaughter mentions this in her introduction, but I think it's super important, which is one of the ways in which Jesse Redmond Fawcett is sort of unlike other Harlem Renaissance writers is that she does this thing where she's, I think in all of her books, I mean, we've only read two of them, but in the two that we've read, there is like a silencing of the Black male voice that's maybe less true in her first novel, but in the second one, in Plum Bun, is very much the case. And that does set her apart from other writers. It is really told from the perspective of Angela and not from the perspective of the men around her. And that is a singular sort of interesting thing that does, like, that's the feminist lens.
Oh, that's great. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm talking with Bremond Berry McDougall and Lisa Cooper about their new press, Quite Literally Books. And so, again, with this theme of feminism, actually, is the book The Homemaker, Dorothy Canfield Fisher. Tell us first about this author.
Dorothy Canfield Fisher was super prolific. She is in the world. She's an interesting character in that she has some really appealing characteristics as a person and in her writing. She also has some more problematic characteristics, as a lot of male authors do, that we tend to overlook, or we say, oh, their writing is so great, we can put that aside. But Dorothy Canfield Fisher, she was very much part of uplifting Black women and uplifting women, but she was also part of the eugenics movement. So she has some dissonance there in her background. The book, The Homemaker, is radically feminist and a really exhilarating, fun thing to read. I mean, not fun in that it's light and frothy, but fun in that it's just so wonderful to see these characters and what happens to them, to see how the female character, how Evangeline goes from being this unhappy and stifled and just really suffering housewife and gets the opportunity to become a working woman and put all of her talents to work and to be so successful and so happy in what she's doing and so happy to let someone else feed her children and do the things that she did well, but they made her miserable. It's an exhilarating thing. And it was unusual then, it's unusual now. It's relevant 100 years later.
Yeah. I was noticing on the Super Bowl yesterday, there was some commercial, I think it was for like Google Pixel or something, but it was sort of like a commercial, like a heartwarming commercial about this man who it looks like he was a stay-at-home husband and, you know, stay-at-home father. And now the daughter has been launched. She's off to college and like he's getting his resume together to go back out into the workforce. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's like Lester from The Homemaker, you know, 100 years later. Because when Evangeline goes to work, her husband, who is a poet and dreamer and not really cut out for the workplace, is left to stay at home with the kids. And it turns out that his nature and that work blend beautifully. And he's very good at being a stay-at-home father and has oodles of patience for his children. And what's really interesting about that to me is that one of the things that Evangeline is pushing against is like there are all these like prescribed ways of doing things. Like she has to meet some sort of metric that has been set for her by society about what a mother does, what a wife does, what that looks like, the right way and the wrong way of doing it. And she's determined to do it the right way, even if it kills them all. Meanwhile, Lester comes in and he's not fettered by that. He can do it however he wants to do. So there's this like amazing scene where they're doing something in the kitchen and he's laid down newspaper all over the floor. And a neighbor comes in and is like, oh my goodness, you know, like there's this huge mess. Like, how are you going to clean it up? And he's like, oh, I'm just going to gather up the newspaper and throw it away. And I remember thinking, A, that's ingenious. And B, I feel like a woman would be criticized for that, you know, for not keeping her home in a way that everyone else expects you to keep the home.
Now, that book was one of the 10 best-selling works of fiction in 1924. What does that tell you, for one thing? And did the critics greet it with the same enthusiasm that the public did?
Critics were mixed. I think there was some criticism that it was unrealistic and, you know, didn't really reflect anything that could be acted upon, that Lester and Evangeline ended up in this situation because he had an accident and they were sort of forced into it. And so it didn't really give women a path or something to look to as a solution. And I guess, you know, that's true to a certain extent, but it was still wonderful to read what happened to them.
Well, what I thought was interesting is that they were, it sounded from the introduction to this book that the critics were kind of outraged, like, how could this ever be that a man could take care of yes. his kids? But what's so also interesting is that it was one of the most popular books of that year.
Well, I think it tells us that some things really haven't changed that much. I mean, you know, it's 100 years ago, but there still aren't that many stay-at-home husbands and fathers, like full time doing that. That conversation and like those sorts of trying to measure up to societal expectations and the guilt and all that, that's still what we're talking about today. So I think it's just, it shows that like 100 years later, it's still very relevant. It's still what we're talking about. It's still what married couples and fathers and mothers are dealing with, you know?
And also there are people now in power in government who are trying to push us back to before 1924.
Well, she was hugely popular, and she is one that has just all but disappeared. I was trying to remember before we came on the show how we found her exactly. A lot of our books kind of come to us like through serendipity. We go to the New York Society Library, which is a subscription library, but it's one, I think it's the oldest library.
Doesn't ever throw anything away.
They don't throw anything away. They have books that are like from the 1800s and have not been checked out in like 100 years. And we go there and quite literally we walk along the shelves and we're looking, you know, running our fingers along the spines, looking for a name that is recognizably a woman's name. And when we find it, we'll Google it and see, you know, if she's American or what her story is. And I think that's actually how we found Amelia. And she's got a bunch. She had so many books. So we pulled them, started reading them, and turned out like they're highly readable books. We have a few of hers that we would like to put back into print, but she is one who is very much like out of the, yes. the print cycle. Yeah.
Yes. I don't think anyone's ever heard of her.
And I wouldn't say that she, for me, what I like about that book is it's just a fun read. You don't have to think too hard on this one. You can just sit down and enjoy it. If you like stories like we talked about it being sort of like Jane Eyre meets a little princess. There's an orphan, a young girl who's an orphan. She goes off to a big scary house and her relatives are really mean to her. They're so mean. There's a love story tucked in there. There's a family secret. So it's just a really fun, good, easy read. And sometimes you just need that, especially now. I think you just need that.
Yeah, exactly. Now, these are really books of an other time, you know, when mores were different, people used different kinds of language, the styles were quite different. How do you deal with the issue of that kind of anachronisms, let's say?
We talked for, I don't know,
years, actually,
really, yes, about how we thought about those things and how we were going to deal with them. And we did some work with a wonderful DEI specialist to sort of help us think about, you know, when you're talking about plum bun, for instance, there is language in plum bun that, you know, is offensive to people. It's used by a Black author. We don't want to change that. Those were Jesse Redmond Fawcett's words. Those are the words that she used. And so we don't want to change that, but we want to be aware and make our readers aware that we've made a conscious decision to leave the books as they are, knowing that they are perhaps out of step with the way we look at things today.
Also, we discussed this, Bramon, that like It's not just that they were, you know, are of another time and place. Like, yes, and that's like, I think that's the first line of our publisher's note. But what we're saying is the language, the social sensibility, some of the racial depictions, like they're jarring and objectionable to us today. And they ought to have been back then as well. And there were people for whom it was absolutely objectionable. But we're trying to, number one, that is a part of our collective literary past in America. It is sometimes shocking to us, like it is in the air we breathe and the water we drink, and we can't ignore that. And that being said, when we put things back into print, we understand that there are going to be people who experience that, like read that, see those words, and it can be potentially harmful to people. So we do have a publisher's note that discusses that and hope that everybody who engages with these texts are doing it, you know, understanding that real engagement is emotional, that it's personal, can be potentially painful, and that we want our readers to be able to hold the nuance and be able to sit with difficult questions, be able to engage in challenging thoughts, challenging texts. Our authors are probably going to be challenging in some ways, like Dorothy Canfield Fisher is. But we just hope that we can create like a reading community that can have these conversations, like have real conversations, and not whitewash things, pretend like it doesn't happen, pretend like it doesn't mean what it does. Like real engagement is what we're hoping comes out of these books.
Oh, that's great. Now I see, just finally, one of your upcoming books is a feminist utopian novel about a female society that can reproduce without men. It's called Her Land by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And I have to tell you that I read it as a young woman in the 1970s, along with Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex. And, you know, it had an impact on me. So I look forward to having that. I mean, I carried it around with me for many, many years. I think it's lost now. But
I love that book. I was so excited when we found that. I read it and I thought about it for such a long time afterward. So we're really excited to bring that one back, because I think it will spark conversations, and it will be exciting for a new generation of readers to read that.
And it's so interesting in this moment, right? Like it feels even more relevant. And I think one of the really nice things about it is, Francesca, you're saying like it was something you read in the 70s. We just read it recently. And then we know a couple of people, especially the woman who is going to be writing our introduction for us. She loves this book and she's quite a bit younger than we are, and it resonates with her. So this is definitely one that we want to bring to another generation of readers and to revive it. I mean, again, it's one of those that you can find out there. It is not, you know, hasn't disappeared, but it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention. And boy, do we think it's relevant right now.
Well, I'm so glad, Brahman, Barry McDougall, and Lisa Cooper, that you have gotten together to create this new publishing house, Quite Literally Books, and to talk with us about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca. This was great. Thank you.
Find a link to Quite Literally Books at writersvoice.net. And tune in next week for more of our Black History Month programming, when we talk with Aaron Shetterly about his history of the 1979 Greensboro Massacre, Morningside. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.